Well, dang, y'all.
The sound is a bit on the fuzzy side.
Welcome to Mintcast, the podcast by the Linux Mint community for all users of Linux. This is episode 342. Livestream information is at mintcast.org/livestream. We're in the Mintcast channel in IRC at irc.spotchat.org. If you see something that you'd like to hear about, tell us. Send us email at mintcast@mintcast.org. Join us live on YouTube. Post at the Mintcast subreddit. Chat with us on Telegram, Discord, and Facebook. Or post directly at mintcast.org. This is Leo. And with me today are Joe.
Hello.
Tony Hughes.
Hi, guys.
Tony Watts.
Hey, y'all.
And Moss.
Hello.
We're recording on Sunday, August 23rd, 2020. This is the 50th episode for the current team. So on and off again, this is us. First up in our wanderings, I've been testing out a new keyboard. Tony Hughes tries to remove a finger again. Joe has been soldering and reading. Moss has been adding more distros, and I... Oh, wait, I've already said what I've done. Then, in our news, Pinta, Lutris, and Mozilla. In security, we talk recommendations and the NSA. So, digging into some errors I got last stream on YouTube. This is what I've been putting my head toward lately. It was complaining that I was streaming at only, I think it was 3,500 kilobits per second. Now, this was actually kind of odd for me because I'd never seen this before. I just use the OBS defaults, right? I mean, it comes pre-installed. It was fine forever. So all of a sudden in the YouTube log where you live stream, YouTube was coming up and saying 3,500 kilobits detected, 4,500 kilobits if you want, you know, the best. Or so I can't remember exactly what the error message was, but it was like that. Nothing broke. Everything seemed to work just fine. So I think it's more just YouTube expects a higher level of quality now than they had in the past. So I cranked that video bitrate up to 6,400 kilobits in the OBS's output section. No errors now. So those of you that are watching the little flippy bars on the live stream, that should be slightly smoother and slightly less grainy for you now. So yay, that was easy. Elsewise, kernel 5.8. I've been testing it out on my desktop, and it turns out, smooth as silk. I have not seen a single issue with kernel 5.8. Now, if Bo were here, he would be telling me that he can't do 5.8 because he has an NVIDIA graphics card and something, 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 the driver, something, something, it always ends up at a black screen. So, I guess it's good to be on AMD hardware. You can just grab the newest of the new. As long as you got a new Mesa, as long as you got a new kernel, you're good. I didn't see any performance increases at all, but 5.8 is the kernel that Linus Torvalds said a few weeks ago that it was one of the biggest kernels of all time. Actually, I think it was the biggest kernel of all time. So, nice. Very cool. I think that means XFAT is in the kernel now, officially.
We're turning into Windows.
Oh, what do you? Why you say that?
With billions of lines of code.
Oh, yeah. Well, at least people can look at this and be like, hey, man, that's bad. You can't do that with Windows. I remember hearing sometime that even teams within Windows that do development on Windows do not know what some... I mean, not that everybody knows what the Linux kernel does, but just that it's so esoteric and separated that you're not even asked to know or asked to look or anything like that.
The word you're looking for is modular.
Yeah, I guess so. It's so just, yeah, modular. And removed from each other that...
Well, that's literally what sunk WordPerfect when they went to a Windows version because they just could not get any information about what needed to go into it, and so it ran poorly. And then they sold out to Novell, and Novell already had some Windows programmers, so it got better. But it was too late
Novell
by then.
Poof.
Well, but Novell wouldn't have gone poof if WordPerfect had maintained the momentum they had before coming out with Windows.
Well, there was a bunch of other missteps for Novell, too, because I was working as an admin doing Novell their... Oh, what was it? I remember the Active Directory thing. It was called Console 1, And I was in that all day, every day, resetting people's passwords and stuff. So, yeah, there were more missteps than just Corel.
And to close that statement, we still do have WordPerfect. Corel still runs it, but nobody uses it outside of legal offices.
Nice. Well, that's cool, though. I mean, it's good to have options. Additionally, got a new keyboard. I don't know. I'm a keyboard guy. I don't know why, but I just keep buying them. And it's lucky for me. I've seen where you can custom build a keyboard for like $450. Yeah, it's a little way. It's okay. That's way out of my price range. I'm like, if it's $50, maybe I'll consider. If it's $30, that's probably a good buy. So
you can build it for cheaper than that.
Well, yeah, but not if you get what you want.
Yeah. Well, no. You can build it cheaper for that with MX Cherry whatevers.
MX Cherry Pinks?
Whatevers.
The last time I priced out MX Cherry Pinks, they were $4 a switch, and there are 100 and something keys on the keyboard.
Okay. Yeah. Maybe then with the Pinks, that's a bit more expensive. But with the MX Cherry Blues, I'm looking at ordering a set of 90 MX Cherry Blues for around $35.
Oh, so wherever you're looking, link that Amazon to me. And okay. So find out how much Pinks are. If you can do that during the show. Otherwise, I'll look after the show.
They had a whole bunch of different ones on that page. So yeah, I'll look and see if Pinks were on the list.
Well, let me tell you, the reason, outside of price, one of the reasons I didn't go with it is because these are $30. And I feel like that's a pretty good buy for, these are Otemu red switches. So they're not cherries, they're, I won't really say a knockoff, but I mean, kind of a knockoff.
Yeah, I guess these are Gatorons, MX type.
Yeah. And Gatoron and Otemu are similar in that they're kind of meant for the tinkering people. Or people that just want a mechanical keyboard that don't want to spend $100+ on it.
Right.
That's Gatoron.
And Otemu, actually, a lot of people buy the Otemu keyboards so that they can put Gatoron switches in them.
Yeah, but you went with reds. Why not go with blues?
Because blues are... Oh, we've had this conversation, Joe. I can't do it.
I know. That's why I brought it up again.
It's so loud. Why do you want people in the next room to know that you're typing? I don't know why.
I want people in the next county to know that I'm typing.
Oh, God. It's so gross.
No. What I really want is for Moss to know that I'm typing.
But yeah. you always know that I'm typing. I don't have blues.
Exactly. I can't beat the keyboard as hard as you do, so I need MX Cherry Blues.
There you go. So if I were to go with something that gave feedback, I'd go with browns. I've got a set of Otemu browns, and they're just too loud.
Okay. So the browns do make some noise. Now, I thought the browns were the basically the double pressure, where you go partway down and you feel some tactile feedback, and then you go the rest of the way down.
I would say browns are probably the closest thing you can get to like just a $10 keyboard that you buy off the shelf, but it feels way better, I think, in general, and the actuation force. So like the weight that you have to put on the key to make it go is way less, and I love that. And that's why I like the red switches.
I do like the double actuate. Darn it, now I can't English.
Yeah, exactly.
I do like that, you get that feedback partway down to let you know when it engages, but you can press it the rest of the way down.
Yeah, and I do. I've got a heavy finger. And I think that's why I like the red switches. They bought them out, with a whole lot less force than pretty much any other keyboard. Mm-hmm. So I've got cherry blacks, I've got cherry pinks, I've got cherry reds, I've got Otemu reds, I've got Otemu browns. And I've played with all of those, and I gotta say, for the price, Otemu red switches, spend $8 and buy like a 200 pack of the little rubber O-rings that go under the key. It reduces the amount of travel the key has. So I think for $40, $42, something like that, I have one of my favorite keyboards of all time. You can't beat it. You cannot beat it.
But if you can get
so
all
good.
Those keys, then yeah, you could definitely build your own keyboard easy enough.
Oh yeah, for sure.
So you guys want me to get a louder keyboard, is that it?
Oh, a quieter one. Get reds and the O-rings.
That's what it is.
I'm talking about.
I'm looking up Otemu blue switches right now.
Yeah, they'll be real cheap. They are not expensive switches at all, which is why you can sell a keyboard for $30.
I'm taking the opposing team. Louder keyboard, Moss. Louder.
I'm looking up Otemu blues right now.
Problem being that I use one of the, quote, natural, end quote, keyboards. The unnatural ones that fit your hands instead of the natural ones that fit the square, the rectangular keyboard. Yeah. And it's harder to find switches for that.
I like the plain rectangle just simply because it can be smaller. That was actually the biggest reason I bought this keyboard. I've got a Corsair Strafe with pinks that it's just too long. Like my mouse is way over in Neverland and my keyboard is right in front of me and it makes me lean weird and my back hurts. So,
well, I'm an 80 plus word per minute typist and you got to have, after a while, your wrists start hurting if you don't have the special keyboard.
Yep. Yeah. Well, love my keyboard. It's fantastic. I think it was a company called Havit, H-A-V-I-T. Super, super good. I'm thinking about buying another one for in here. I have blacks in here, which are stiffer, and it's got a retro feel to it, and I love that. It's that old tan.
You're telling me you
got to
have
brown.
It.
Sadly, my Red Dragon is at the office and has been, you know, since like March. So I haven't seen it. And I missed that feedback, so...
Yeah. Well, this is you could buy like three of these mechanical keyboards for the price of one Cherry mechanical keyboard. So, I mean, go wild, man.
Well, the Red Dragon wasn't that expensive. And yeah, it had blue knockoffs. So I'm not sure what it exactly had. I know it said MX Cherry Blue, but obviously for the price that I paid for it, it wasn't MX Cherry Blues.
Well, it was... I see a lot when I look at these keyboards. MX Cherry Blue equivalent. That's what I see all the time. Yeah. Anyway, love my keyboard. The other go ahead.
Now, one more question on the same topic. Now, you've mentioned the Otemus and the, what was the other ones? The
Gateron.
Gaterons. Now, have you heard of Kail? K-A-I-L-H?
Yes. The website I was talking about that I saw the pinks were like $4 or $5 a piece. I saw the list of all the different kinds of switches that you could get, and that was on the list. So I don't know how good they are. I mean, obviously they're good enough to sell at $2-$3 a piece, but
yeah.
I don't know how good they really are.
Right. Right. I'm just wondering, it'd be better to get those or the Gaterons. And there's only like, actually they're a little bit more expensive than the Gaterons.
Really? Well, yeah, that would make sense.
Hmm. Okay.
All right.
I'll stop talking about keyboards for a little bit.
I know.
I'll pick it up again in a little bit too, though.
Okay. I love it. Anyway, the last thing, and this is not normal for me. I usually talk about just tech stuff, but now I've wandered into the nerd realm. Star Trek. I am not a Star Trek fan, but I have found a Star Trek show that I can watch, and that is Star Trek Lower Decks. This is not really a Star Trek show. Imagine Rick and Morty plus Futurama and plus Star Trek. That is what this is. And it's mostly a comedy show. It's about I think it's like five ensigns that work on the starship Cerritos, and they're not high ranking. They just do grunt work all the time. But it's just their problems and day to day, and it's hilarious. Hijinks obviously ensue. Season one started a couple of weeks ago, and I don't know. It's pretty good. I like it. It's pretty awesome.
I've been hearing a lot of good things about that show, but I haven't seen it yet myself. Cerritos, by the way, is one of the downscale neighborhoods in Los Angeles County.
Oh, cool. So, yeah, don't go into that show expecting all of the amazing Star Trek everything that you expect out of a normal Star Trek show. It is not that show. Go into it expecting a comedy show that has Star Trek elements in it, and I think you won't be disappointed. Anyway, Tony Hughes, what have you been up to?
They got him.
They got him. They called him out. Tony, where are you?
We miss you, Tony.
I'm back. I lost me show notes.
Ah!
I've been going up and down on Mumble this show, so.
Right, okay. So, as Leo alluded to here on in the show at the beginning, I had a little accident while I was drilling out one of my models, and a drill bit snapped and... it didn't actually go through my finger, but it took a big chunk out of it. And, it's over 2 weeks ago now, and it's still numb. So, My wife seems to think I've got a death wish because of all the times I cut myself in the kitchen or doing modelling and things.
You're just really after nine fingers, I think.
Yeah.
Nine-fingered Frodo.
Oh, dear. So, anyway, as a result of the accident, I've not done much in the way of restoration for the last couple of weeks, but I've made a couple of nice eBay buys, which have resulted in the collection growing, and both for actually putting on display and the spares bin. Although, because I'm now away, I had to stop bidding on stuff because it wouldn't have arrived until after I'd left. And trying to get parcels again once when you've been away for a couple of weeks and you come home and there's a left delivery card. It's a bit of a complicated hassle, so it saved me a few shekels anyway, so I'll have the money there to have another go when I get back. So for a little light relief instead, I decided to install Ubuntu Touch onto my OnePlus One, and that was it was a fairly painless process, actually. Unlike trying to get the update for Lineage OS to 17.1 from 16. I still haven't managed to be able to get that on.
May have some tips for you, right, on that. I've been through that process.
Yeah.
Perhaps.
For some reason, what's the name of the app that you use for downloading and installing? I can't remember what it's called now.
The Team Win Recovery Project?
No, Recovery? I use a different one. TWRP. Yeah, it is. Yeah, Team Win.
Same.
Oh, yeah.
I just know it as TWRP. I don't think about it.
Yeah, I call it that too. Yes.
Yeah, for some reason, it won't work. It says it's installing it, and then it just goes back to the TWRP after it's done it.
One thing you may want to check if you haven't already accounted for this, Tony, is to make sure you're running the most recent TWRP. Otherwise, that can cause problems for you when you go to a new Lineage version. That tripped me up for a bit.
Yeah, unfortunately, I didn't do a backup, and now I can't boot into Lineage at all to update TWRP.
Well,
that's okay.
Actually, I'm sorry, but it's been a long time since I've done TWRP, or, there was another one before that I can't remember the name of, but Odin on a Windows system. And I don't know if they actually finally made one for a Linux system, but you can use Odin and ADB to install TWRP.
Actually, what I found that's far easier even than that is just using the ADB tools built into Linux that you can install with just, you know, sudo apt install and do the same thing. You can flash it from the bootloader and flash recovery.
I was trying to do that as well, and that wouldn't work.
Okay. I feel like we can get you going, but maybe we won't bore our listeners with this further, but I feel like I can help.
Well, actually, maybe some of the listeners are actually quite interested in it. It might be a topic for a future instance.
Yeah,
that sounds right.
We need a show that's just basically all flashing Android devices.
Oh, buckle up. That's going to be a long one or a multi-parter.
Well, I've got a Nexus 7 that I play around with Lineage on, and so I could just reflash that with something else if you guys can help me find a ROM for it.
I've got an S7 that could definitely use a new ROM.
I finally got a spare phone that I could flash onto, and I can't find anything that works on that model. So,
yeah, that's
anyway,
a thing.
Back to Ubuntu Touch.
Back to that, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it worked. I got it installed, but it's not very usable. There's a long way for it to go before it becomes a usable OS for day-to-day use. Everything seems to be web app. So if you're out and about and you want to use SatNav and stuff like that, you've got to have a SIM card, and because you can't just use your GPS. Because you need access to the internet to be able to get the web app to work. So you need a data plan, which I was planning on using the spare phone as a sat nav and just using it on GPS, but you can't.
Wouldn't that be the case with Android too? It would, right? You need a data signal there. So, I mean, that's, I don't know. That's a limitation you'll have with any device, I guess.
With most of your Android devices, you only need data when you're at home. Get the maps downloaded.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. If you download the offline maps, you don't need to be online. But with Ubuntu Touch, because everything's web-based, you do.
Oh, okay. I'm learning, I guess. I didn't realize data wasn't used there. I just assumed it was.
It's a nice bit of kit. I was getting used to navigating through everything and stuff like that, but it's still got a way to go before it becomes a day-to-day user.
I have a couple of quick questions on that. Did you test the camera at all?
I did. I found that a bit flaky. It wasn't focusing properly.
I was just going to say that was my experience as well with my OnePlus device. Or no, I'm sorry, I had it on a Nexus. But I think that's more a result of they're trying to work with the proprietary hardware and drivers and all that stuff, and that's why that's probably not perfect. I would expect one of the open phones to be better in that regard when they come out, but was just curious what your experience was.
It took a reasonable picture, but because it wasn't completely in focus, it was just a little bit, just a bit off. But anyway, so that was, if you want to just have a mess around with Ubuntu Touch on any phone that it supports, go and give it a go, but don't expect miracles. That's all I'd say.
Yeah, but on a positive note, to test it out and play around with it, it's not hard to get on with. The installer is really great, isn't it?
Yeah, no, UbiPorts was great. Yeah, I really loved that. Once I got it installed and did it, it was a piece of cake to get it on. Yeah, it's not that difficult at all. So, as well as mucking around with the OnePlus One, I've been continuing to play with Mint 20 Mate on the DHD laptop with the intention of doing a review for September. And given my findings so far, apart from the SnapD issue and a few programs being updated, it's pretty much business as usual. I don't think I'm going to have an awful lot to say about it, really. I'm having a play with Sparky Linux, as was suggested by one of our listeners. It's based on Debian, but they actually do two spins. They do a spin based on Stable, which is just going to be another Debian-based distro, basically, so I wouldn't have been much interested in that. But they also do one based on testing as a semi-rolling release. And that's what Linux Mint Debian Edition used to be based on. It used to be based on testing. Now, Linux Mint decided that for their user base, it was a bit too flaky for that. But Sparky Linux, it very clearly says if you know what you're doing and you're not a brand new user and you want more cutting-edge software, go with the semi-rolling. If you need something that's stable, or you're not a very au fait Linux user, go with the stable Debian base. But something of it that I noticed that was quite interesting is the ISO size is still way less than 2 gig. You can get the Mate one and the XFCE and the other ones on round about 1.7, 1.8 gig. But if you go for one of the minimal installs, a couple of them even come in at under 1 gig. So if you've got a couple of, any old USB flash drives knocking around and you're wondering what to do with them, then Sparky Linux could actually work on them. There are other distros out there that still come in at less than 2 gig, but this is the one that I'm playing with at the moment. So, I've already noticed a bug in it that I'll probably see about reporting. When you open up, if you open up a program, the example was Mumble, and then I repeated it with Calibra. If you open up a dialog box from within a program, it doesn't give you the close down X on the right hand top corner. So the only way of closing the dialog box down is to close the program down. And it happened when I went into the info dialog box for books on Calibra. There was no X to close it down. So the only way I could get rid of it was to close Calibra and then restart it.
You did try Alt F4, Tony? Alt F4 works on Windows and it works on a lot of Linux distros.
Ooh, no, I didn't, but thank you for that. That's a good clue, but I'd still like the X back on top of the box.
Yeah, really. But yeah, Alt F4, I love it. I use it all the time when weird stuff happens, and if it doesn't close by itself, you'll eventually get that whole, hey, this is not responding, do you want to kill it? So yeah. That's nice.
Oh no, the actual program was working. It's just I'd opened up the box to see the detail on the book, or in Mumble I was opening up the record box so that I could set up where I wanted to save any recordings and stuff like that, but there was no way of shutting it down. Whereas if you even you could press start recording, stop recording, but you then couldn't close the box.
Right, and using Alt F4 would close out the whole program, not just that box.
Ah, so it wouldn't work then. Because I could close the program.
Well, it closes the current window is what it does.
Well, it should be in your Windows setting somewhere to be able to add that back in.
Right. I'll have a delve around anyway. But yeah, it was just a bit strange. Not an issue I've come up with before. Anyway, so finally, I wrote the fourth of my Full Circle magazine series on podcast production, and sent that to Ronnie. The first one was in the latest issue 159 at the end of July. So if you want to go and check out my little writing about how I do podcast stuff, it's going to be a series over the next few months. I'm not a natural writer, but I've actually been enjoying sharing what I've learned, you know, down on paper and sending it off. So yeah, it's good. Learned quite a bit in the last 2 years on Mintcast, and subsequently since me and Moss started Distro Hoppers, it's been great. So that's me. Moss, what have you got?
Well, I will totally agree with you on that last point. What I have learned since getting on the Mintcast crew has been enormous compared to what I knew before. Okay, I installed Gecko Rolling to my desktop, so now I've got Rolling on the desktop and Static on my laptop, which is the equivalent of OpenSUSE Tumbleweed and Leap, respectively. On the 15th, I installed KDE Neon, also to my desktop. Oddly, the announcement that Neon was available based on 20.04 did not mention that you would still be installing the 18.04 version and then be greeted with the upgrade button. It took a few more button pushes to get the upgrade started, but it ran beautifully. I then ran my updates and installed some of my more common additions, including Stacer 1.10. Stacer ran great, but Discover popped up and said there's an update to it. So I ran the update, and now Stacer wouldn't load. It said program not found. So I reinstalled from my deb package, and it worked again. And Discover said there was an update again. I did not install it, did not update it that time. I have posted to the KDE Neon user forum to report this issue and ask how I can get Discover to ignore the update. Apparently, KDE thinks that when there is an app in the repo, that app is newer than the same app from a deb file. But why it disables the program to run the update is beyond me. So, note to myself, check the repo to see if an application is there before installing saved deb files. I pointed out with 18.04, we got Grub Customizer in the repo, but I never had a problem with installing it from other sources. This is the first time I have installed a source that I already had and been told, oh, you need to update that, and then it kills it. So, I now only have one free partition each on my desktop and laptop. Starting to have memory issues. Not my computer, me, trying to remember what all I have installed. Updating has already gotten beyond the fun level.
That would be my problem right there, man. I wouldn't even remember what I had installed, much less to keep them updated and deal with all the other fun stuff that
people,
comes along with it.
On a lot of groups I'm on, people go, well, what do you have installed on your system? I go, you don't want to ask me that.
We'll be here for 30 minutes.
I am tempted to install Relax Linux to my system, even though it's only a 0.5 beta. This is a fully independent distro out of India with a new package manager and everything. It's got a new installer, it's got a new package manager, it's got their own repos. Everything is being done from the ground up. Sounds really exciting, and maybe I should dig up Tony Hughes' instructions and learn how to install it in a VM.
You should have been using VMs years ago.
Well, but I didn't even know about them years ago. It's only since you started talking to me about them. And I have this reluctance. I want it on metal. I want to see how it runs on metal. And people keep telling me, well, but just run it in a VM. Well, that doesn't tell me how it runs on metal.
The idea is that you run it in a VM, you get a little bit familiar with it, then you put it on metal, and you've got an idea how to fix things.
Well, see, you're the only one that puts it that way. Everyone else says, oh, I run all my stuff in VMs. Well, but that doesn't tell me how it runs. It just tells me that you can run it in a VM.
Yeah.
But in this case, since I don't want to mess up my system when I've got it this far along, I probably want to run a VM for this first. I've got a new blog on Linux questions. I do that every now and again. I have been sort of stalled on the itsmos.com stuff. I've been asking people to write about things that they are talking about and send them to me. So if anyone has an article that they think would do good on itsmos, just something instructive, please send it to me. I did some performing on Thursday the 20th on Eurofilk, which is now happening every other Thursday. I got to play with Cecilia Ang, first time for me, and she's a legend, and a total of 9 others in the Zoom room, including my friend Carl Johan Noren. This is the first performing I've done since about 2 weeks after my accident. My shoulder hurt a lot more afterward, but I seem to have gained some mobility. In other words, it was a lot easier to wash my hair the other day. Suzanne and I are about 2/3 of the way through Blood Rites, the 6th Dresden Files book. Dresden missed a huge hint when he had a major data download from Thomas. There's no explanation for that miss. We're enjoying the book. We just wish Dresden could be more successful stopping people from dying. Speaking of which, oh, you got something for me?
Oh, I was just going to make a comment on something you said earlier, so finish your thought up.
Oh, I was just going to pass it on.
I just wanted to say that Relax Distro, I know that it's Relax, and I know that it was a typo in the first place, but don't forget, it's a Relax.
Yeah, they applied for, apparently the guy that applied for the website for it spelled it R-E-L-E-A-X and didn't notice that until they already had it registered and paid for, and they said, oh, well, at least people will be able to tell us apart from the others, but they do pronounce
exactly
it Relax.
Right. Yeah.
So, Joe.
Who?
You.
Oh, me.
What's going on, bud?
Well, I've watched a lot of YouTube and a lot of Netflix, like a lot. And I did some soldering. I took a break for a few days from reading, but I still got a bit in. I'm up to book 20 in the Drist books, about halfway through that book, and it just started really dragging. So I switched to some other stuff for a while. I listened to Demon Accords, book 16, which... pretty good. The series is dragging on a bit long. And I listened to a book called Big Damn Hero, which is a Firefly book, and surprisingly good. Most of the time when you get like a book that is based on a TV series, they're trying to just throw so much nostalgia at you that it really overshadows the story itself. But that really wasn't the case with this. And then...
Well, that's shiny.
Yeah, right? And then I started a book this morning, Soulwood Book 1, which is an offshoot of another book series that I was reading, both by Faith Hunter, and the other one was the Jane Yellowrock series. Seems good so far. I did a bit of soldering on some headphones. I got the new MMCX connectors and the proper ones instead of, you know, 3D printing housings for makeshift ones. I did 2 sets of headphones with that, and it came out well. I only need to redo one of the connections at this point, and that was a glue issue, so it eventually came undone. And I'll just need to redo that one. I was informed by a listener that I missed the 8th book in the Incarnations of Immortality series by Piers Anthony's. And although I'm a bit disillusioned by Piers Anthony's work, since he used it as a platform to push his ideology on the Age of Consent, and the book doesn't exist in audio format, so if I do end up listening to it, it's going to be text aloud. But I don't know. I like some of Piers Anthony's work, and it's just the... It seems like each of his book series, he tries to slip that little ideology in there, and it bothers me. I attempted to make that macro keyboard I was talking about on the last show. I followed the instructions exactly, but I wasn't able to get it working, at least not correctly. I rechecked my soldering several times, but my soldering was solid. And I was only able to get 6 keys of the 12 working. And I took it apart. Took apart the keypad down to the board and did a continuity test on the whole thing. And yeah, it's a bad board. And the pinout was slightly different than was listed in the instructions, but that shouldn't have mattered. I could try to solder directly to the board and to the pins, but that seems a little crazy even for me. Although if I get bored enough, you never know. I will have to order some extremely thin enameled wire to do that and still have the front piece fit on correctly, but that's not too much of an issue. In the meantime, I've ordered a couple of different types of keyboards or keys for keyboards to give a try using different methods. Right before the show, I ordered a test set of 4 mechanical keys, and they showed up this morning, and it's made to just have different MX Cherry keys on it and see how you like the different ones. But the pins are exposed in the bottom, so I can use it as an actual macro keyboard if I wire it up. And so I've got the wiring done for that out from the keys, but not to the Pro Micro, which I'm going to use as the brains. And then I still need a 3D printer case for it. Most of the work is done, and except for the programming, that shouldn't be too difficult for me. It's been a while since I've done anything with, I believe it's called processing, but it's not difficult. I'm also thinking about ordering a set of 90 MX Cherry Blue equivalents and 3D printing everything, the keycap covers, the housing, everything, and then just soldering it in place there. I might go up to an 8-key keyboard, but I'm definitely not going to do a full keyboard. That's just way too much work for what I'd get out of it. And that's about it for me. It's short for me. Tony, Watts, what have you been up to?
Well, man, I have been doing some things in my basement, which explains why I almost didn't make it here. I have been refinishing my basement to turn this into a practice / rehearsal / studio / home office space. So last week we put some concrete down. I had some friends come over some carpet down over the concrete is what I meant to say. That probably makes a lot more sense. So that's good, but it involved me dismantling everything in the room, including all my podcast setup and everything on that desk. So, that was still disassembled as of yesterday afternoon. But I went ahead and got everything put back together, in time to join you guys today.
Now, was that for aesthetics or was that for, echo control?
Largely the latter. I mean, both. It looks a lot nicer, but, I am going to start having a music practice in this room in a few days. So I was trying to cover all the concrete in the room, which was the floor and one wall. And so I was able to do that. I've got the concrete covered on the floor with the carpet. And then on that one wall, I just leaned some drywall on the bottom part. I haven't actually framed a wall or anything like that, but that covered the bottom half of it, and I've got some heavy fabric covering the top half, so there's no more exposed concrete anymore, so the sound should absorb pretty well. Next thing I'm working on doing is putting some insulation in the ceiling, and then lastly I'll start framing some walls, and most of them don't require framing, just drywall. But the one thing I have been kind of hesitating before I do that on is I probably should get a permit from the county if I want this to really count as finished space in the house, so they can come and check the, you know, electrical and ductwork and all that before I cover it up. It's a lot, but one step at a time. So the other thing that I did that also kind of put me at risk of joining is I just updated my machine that I do the podcasting on today to from Mint 19.3 to 20. No big deal, though. That was fairly seamless. I was just kind of doing it at the last minute. So, the upgrade only had a couple of very minor issues. It did break grub for some reason, which no big deal. I fixed that really easily using a... I used the MX Linux Live USB boot repair. That just seems really, really easy. It's the fastest tool I probably have tried. So courtesy of my Ventoy disk that has a million other things on it, it also has the MX Linux Live, and I fixed grub. And then the other issue I ran into is, I think it's to do with the Mumble version. You guys have talked about this before, and I just haven't ran into it, but once I went to Mint 20, it pushed me into the next version of Mumble, which didn't work with our server, and I had to install the flat pack version, and that worked just fine. Let's see. I guess those are a few things that I have been up to. The last thing I want to talk about, this is pretty cool. I'm excited about it. I installed Linux on this Chromebook. I mentioned last week that I was going to do it, and I installed Linux desktop on the Chromebook using Crouton. This is an Acer 314 that I got for my son to do school on. And it does have a supported Linux feature in it. That's called Crustini. And that was great, but it was somewhat useless to me because you don't have in Linux, it spins up like a VM. And you can install all of your Linux apps right there in Chrome OS, which is great, except you don't have support of USB devices. So I can't, for example, in that Linux, use my audio interface with the Chromebook, which is really the main thing I would want to do so that I can use Audacity or, you know, OBS or something with the Chromebook and use my audio interface with it. So that didn't work in Crustini, which is the Linux feature that's supported by Google and built into the thing. But Crouton is a bit of a hack using chroot that allows you to install the full Linux desktop onto the Chromebook. And I just did that today. Like, literally as we were starting this podcast was the first time that I actually went into the Linux desktop on this machine.
Taking a walk on the wild side there, Tony.
Yeah, really.
Everything I've been doing is like right down to the last minute today. But it is awesome. It is so cool. So the default for Crouton is XFCE. So I didn't change that. But you do also have as options, get this, Cinnamon is one of the desktop choices that you can use. KDE, E17, LXDE, and Unity. You can choose from any of those. Given this is not obviously a real beefy machine, I thought XFCE was a pretty logical default, so I just left it at that. But the process to install this thing, it goes something like this. You have to turn on developer mode on the Chromebook, so that will erase all of the local data on the machine. From there, you just follow some pretty simple instructions in Crush, which is the Chrome OS terminal that just runs in a tab of Google Chrome. You can get a shell in there, and once you have developer mode enabled, you can follow the instructions to install. Once it's installed, then anytime you want to run Linux, you just have to do either sudo enter chroot start xfce4, or you can go a little bit shorter and just do sudo start xfce4, and that will launch, that'll launch the XFCE desktop or whatever desktop you've chosen. One of the coolest things I think is that you can really easily toggle back and forth between your Linux desktop and Chrome OS by just choosing Control Alt Shift back or forward. And it's instant and it works amazingly. And last thing, it was a great success with my audio interface. That worked perfectly. When I'm in XFCE, have the PreSonus audio interface plugged in, USB, it picks it right up, detects it, and it works. So I've got OBS Studio, Audacity, and Mumble installed on this thing, and it works with my audio interface. So that being the case, and because it's a Chromebook, the battery life is like 12 hours on this thing. So you combine all that, and I will be using it, I'm sure. Some downsides, you do have to have developer mode enabled, which does introduce some security risk. However, you can encrypt the Linux installation as one of the options when you install it. But developer mode, one of the reasons that's a downside for me is this is a family used machine. My kids will use it. And if you power it up from being turned off, it greets you with a screen that says you have developer mode enabled and just press space to, you know, restore it to the way it was. So with just pressing the space bar, my kids can kind of wipe out my whole Linux installation real easily. Not a big deal. I wouldn't sweat it too much if that happened, but that is a bit of a downside of developer mode. Also, this is not officially supported by Google, so the next Chrome OS update can easily break this thing. Again, I don't really care. Another thing that I did notice is the default install is Ubuntu 16.04, so that is older, obviously, but I believe you can specify at least 18.04 in the commands when you're doing the installation. You can specify the version. So for whatever reason, it's still defaulting to 16.04, but I'm sure you can go higher than that. I think that's about everything I've got on that. Shall we head on into some news?
Let's! In the news, what do we got? We got just a couple, actually. After 5 years, a new release of drawing app Pinta. Have you guys actually used Pinta before?
I haven't used it, but I grabbed the article off of its FOSS, which I always recommend people checking out on a regular basis. It's available for Linux, Windows, and Mac, but boy, it's been 5 years since the last update. They've done a lot of updating, and it's only 1.7 version number.
This is my go-to. If you don't want all the crazy heavy lifting that GIMP will give you, but you still want the ability to add a couple of filters here and there, do some quick cropping, something like that. Pinta is great. I really love it. It is, think of Microsoft Paint, but on steroids. It's got a ton more features than Paint provides, but it's got the simplicity of Paint. All you're really doing is just, you know, drawing on some stuff or doing some cropping, and it's really easy to get into. So this is fantastic. I love this.
I think I'm going to go install it after this is show's
take
over.
Take a look at Pinta. It's actually really good for some basic editing.
Don't want to do it right now, especially while I'm running a Mumble recording.
So go check it out. If you haven't checked it out, Pinta's really good. Give it a shot. The next little bit is kind of sad news, but it's not too terribly bad because you can still run it. Lutris drops support for Linux Mint.
No.
What? It doesn't matter. You can still run it. So there was some drama going on, and whatever. It doesn't matter. So in Reddit, basically, someone had made a post a while back saying, "Hey, I've noticed that Linux Mint has been taken off the icon. So when you go to Lutris and install it, it's like, here's how you do it on Ubuntu. Here's how you do it on Pop OS. Here's how you do it. Blah blah blah. Right? Linux Mint used to be there. Now it is not there. And so it sounded like." One of the developers was getting a lot of bug reports specifically from Mint users about hardware. And instead of working on those, as that, you know, it's his project, he can do what he wants. Instead of supporting that, he decided to just drop support for Mint. He doesn't really provide any information as to what was broken. He doesn't share any of the bug reports or any of the information out of the bug reports. He just says, you know, I don't want to have to work on this. Linux Mint guys should fix this. And until they do, he didn't even actually say until they do, but just so because of that, we're going to drop support for it. Meh, whatever. I mean, I guess it still works. So I still use Lutris almost every single day on Linux Mint 20. So I don't know. It'd be nice to know what was actually going wrong. So, I don't know. It didn't even seem like he shared the information with the Linux Mint team, but, you know, again, that's up to him. He can do however he wants. It's his project. Either way, don't sweat it. Still works just fine. I would suspect that some of those hardware issues may have to do with NVIDIA drivers, as the AMD stuff is provided by Mesa, which would be the same in every distribution regardless. So, I don't know. Joe, you seemed a little sad about that. I mean, obviously, you use Lutris, right?
On occasion. It depends.
And you're on NVIDIA?
Yeah. Well, it depends on which computer I'm on. If I'm on my laptop, that's NVIDIA. If I'm on my desktop, that's AMD.
Yeah, and I would imagine the laptop has a few extra things you gotta, a few extra hoops you gotta jump through because it needs the switching.
Yeah, but it's also, you know, where I have Lutris set up, but I've only got it set up for a couple of games, and they're not the one necessarily the ones that I play all that often. Like, I have Batman Arkham Knight set up through Lutris. That's all I can think of off the top of my head.
Yeah, well, if any of you folks that are listening use Lutris on Linux Mint, let us know how it works. Is it working for you? I mean, it's working for me, but I mean, if you're having some of these issues, the issues may stem from something that Mint does, as that is at least what the main dev here is complaining about. So we'll see. We will see. And just to check real quick. Oh, wait, hold on. Ladies and gentlemen, breaking news. Linux Mint's back. Okay, so that was a whirlwind of emotion.
Never mind.
Really? I guess it got fixed? ? Because they're there again. Huh. How weird. Okay. Well, scratch all that. But that drama did happen. I don't know, man. I'll go dig for a statement on this guy. Maybe he said something about it. But yeah, otherwise, cool. Full steam ahead. Steam.
I heard that.
Some somber news, some other somber news. Mozilla lays off 25% of staff. No, this is not deja vu. This is another one. And then pretty quick after that, they got the approval on the whole Google's going to throw billions of dollars at Mozilla over the next couple of years. So, what do you guys make of this?
Well, it's $1 billion over 3 years, but still, if I were working for a company and my boss just laid me off and said, okay, well, you can keep working here until December, and then a week later got told, well, gee, we got another $1 billion coming in over the next 3 years. My first question to my boss would be, so do I still have my job? There hasn't been a word about this on the web.
Or rehiring. I haven't heard anything about rehiring. I mean,
I don't know. I feel like the money issues were probably just one of the reasons they did the layoffs. Not that layoffs are ever any good for the people that get laid off. They're never good. But I don't know. It may just be one on the list. But my guess would be they're not going to hire him back.
So what? They're just going to work with like...
I would have expected that they'd say something staff. About it.
Yeah. I mean, I really do think so. Yeah. A lot of the projects that were in the pipeline were, as far as I know, like... what was it? There was a security feature coming to Firefox. Oh, and a whole new engine. Like, they were getting rid of, is it Gecko right now, is what the rendering engine is? They were rewriting the whole rendering engine in Rust. And I think the bulk of that work got done. And so that team, I think most, if not all of that team got, was part of that layoff, so.
Well, that sucks. If you just finished rewriting your company's main product so that it works better, and they say, okay, thanks, bye.
Yeah, but that's also something that I think is going on with Mozilla, is that I don't know that Firefox is the main product anymore, because it don't make money outside of the Google thing. I guess it does make money, so.
Yeah, $1 billion is a bit of money, you know?
Yeah, true. But, I mean, they're forging their own path with this whole, the VPN thing that doesn't work on Linux. There's the Firefox Send, which is currently off right now. they've got products,
and the VPN
man.
Thing right now only works in the US.
You know what bugs me about that is that it's Mulvad, man, and Mulvad works on Linux.
Right on.
So what's the deal?
I don't know. And not only is it Mulvad, but it's Mulvad through WireGuard, and WireGuard's in the bloody kernel.
Exactly. So my question for this, and I could never really find a straight answer on it, is could you not sign up for Firefox VPN or Mozilla VPN, whatever it is, and then just download the configuration for it and then just use it with WireGuard in the kernel? Why are all the Linux folks getting all bent out of shape about this when I suspect you can do that?
How much are they charging for their VPN?
Wasn't it like $5 a month? It wasn't a lot.
Well, it's only €5 a month to get MolVad, and then you've got all your nodes, not just your browser.
True. Very.
I've got up to 5 active devices. I can run it on 10 devices as long as no more than 5 are active.
Yeah. So that, I don't know, that bugs me because I know you can do that with OpenVPN. Maybe I just do not understand WireGuard enough, but seemed to me that WireGuard was even more accessible than OpenVPN was, and that just, it blows my mind. Why? I do not understand the issue. If you are listening to this, and if you understand WireGuard better than I do, and there is some practical, technical reason that you cannot just take Firefox's info and stuff it into WireGuard from the kernel, please let me know, because I'm of the opinion that I don't see why it wouldn't work.
Yeah, I'm running WireGuard. I'm running MolVad through WireGuard on my Raspberry Pi 4, running Ubuntu Mate, and it works fine. I why would there be a problem running it on Linux on a real computer?
Right. Yeah. Totally. Exactly. I don't know. There's got to be something, because I mean, you saw the heart attack that everybody had on the internet. Oh, Firefox not running on Linux. I mean, or Firefox VPN, and it's like, you sure? I mean, I don't know, but it seems out there, man.
Now, come on, Moss. I've got to disagree with you. The Raspberry Pi is a real computer.
Yeah, I side with Tony on that one.
It's not an x86 64 computer. It's an ARM. And if I can get it to run on non-standard hardware, why wouldn't it run on standard hardware with a standard operating system?
Listen, Debian is as standard as it comes, and that's all you need to know.
Isn't there a certain Fruity-based company that's about to go over to ARM as for their main platform?
Are you talking about Pear Computers?
Strawberry Computers, yeah.
That's it.
And I will point out, Leo, that Debian is not hardware. Debian is software.
Oh, right, but Raspberry Pi with Debian, you're good.
Well, I'm not running Debian. I'm running Ubuntu Mate.
You could just get the Pinebook Pro.
I tried, but they closed the orders before I could get mine in.
I think they're back open, and I'm
so
close.
No, I'm sorry. It was the Pine Tab I got shut out on.
Oh, I got it. I got birthday money burning a hole in my pocket, man, and I'm really looking at a Pinebook Pro. But
okay, buy me one.
It's not powerful enough. I need, like, it needs to be more powerful than what I've got now. And that's really what's making it hard for me to say, yeah, let's just go get it right now.
Well, it's probably more powerful than that HP Stream.
Actually, yeah, I would suspect that it is. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. I feel like I would buy it and then it would just sit on the shelf until I came up with a good idea to use it. And then I would use it for 2 weeks
and then it would
just end up on the shelf again. Yeah. So I don't know. I want hardware that I'm going to use all the time, because I hate being wasteful like that.
Yep.
Anyway, this kind of went away from Mozilla. But anyway, Mozilla. Yeah, so somber news. VPN not on Linux and Send. They need to bring back Send. They need to fix that issue. But Firefox Send. I mean, the whole issue was that they kept getting people uploading malware onto it and then like sending people links. And because of the nature of Firefox Send, they're transient. So, like, the links go away eventually, which makes it really, really enticing for people that don't necessarily want to have a whole lot of paper trail. Having an option out there like that is really difficult to do, especially when there's a free tier and it's basically anonymous. But if they can figure out a way to bring it back, please bring it back. It was so useful. Anyway, enough about Mozilla. KDE Neon. Moss, what is this?
Well, they've upgraded their core packages to 20.04, finally, but they did it so weirdly, as I mentioned earlier, when you download the latest, it downloads as 18.04, and there's a button saying, hey, well, there's a new version, please upgrade. And it takes, you know, 3 or 4 button pushes before it starts upgrading. But it does go to 20.04, and it does work.
Cool. All right. Well, so it's, I mean, I guess you would say it was less complex on the Linux Mint upgrade, right?
Well, yeah, but you'd figure if they had upgraded it to 2004, they would actually publish the ISO in 2004.
Oh, true that, right? Maybe they're just not ready yet.
I don't know. It's like, you got to do it yourself, man. Here's 1804.
Yeah,
we know how that works.
Yeah, I think maybe it's a stability thing, right? I mean, because Neon is already slightly rolling and then making big underlying changes like that. I don't know. Maybe they just need to test more. Maybe that's it. Well, still on the KDE train, Tony Watts, do you use this?
I have, not for a while, and I can't say that I'm a power user by any stretch. But yes, Kden Live is a software that I like. I've done some video editing for some live music stuff that we've recorded to just more or less chop sets into clips of a song here and there to put out on the internet. But Kden Live 20.8 is out now, and with that, one of the big changes there is there are layouts, or they call them workspaces, that are specific to the type of task that you're doing, and the UI will change according to what you're doing. So if you're in a logging phase or you're reviewing the footage, then you get one UI for that versus editing versus audio, which looks really cool, effects and color. And so that is a big change from previous. And there are other features that are available that you can see in the article here. I'm not going to go into a bunch of detail there. But one note, projects in Kden Live are not backwards compatible. So if you try this version and you edit some things and decide you don't like it and want to go back, then you know whatever you've done is not going to work in earlier versions. So keep that in mind if you decide to have a play. Otherwise, one last thing I will mention with this, and maybe it's just me not realizing this, but naturally you can get Kden Live in any version of Linux that you're using, but you can also find builds of Kden Live for Windows and Mac OS, which I did not know. So whatever you're running, go get it.
So, okay, check this out. I just said to Owen, who may or may not be our editor soon, that I would drop Audacity in a heartbeat if Kden Live was two things. Number one, less crashy. That'd be great. Number two, have audio editing tools like a compressor. And Tony, I think you just made my dreams come true. And this was like 2 days ago. What? So, okay. So, okay, I think there's going to have to be a Kden Live Linux innards here pretty soon because, okay. Ah, man.
Yeah,
I'm excited about this. I'm at a loss for words here. I'm excited. Great.
Well, then I should probably mention one of the features that dropped with this, too, is support for multiple audio streams. It looks like they've stepped up the audio game a bit. So, yeah, you may want to give it a spin.
That's what I mean. Like, the blocks are falling together. It has become a true real live audio video editor. Ha! I love it.
Yeah.
I absolutely love it.
It does seem to be getting really close to something you can use for professional workflows, which is over my head, but there's a whole lot coming down.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't happen often, but the couple of times that it did happen to me over the three or four videos that I edited, there were a couple of things on the timeline that got shuffled around a little bit. It wasn't hard to put them back or anything, but it just, that was odd because I know that those things weren't there when it crashed, and I'm pretty sure I saved before the crash so that it wouldn't forget that stuff. So I don't know what was going on with that. But I do use Kden Live quite a bit already just for video editing. I've got a Bash Top video that I've got that I'm working on right now lazily working on right now. And did you guys know, by the way, Bash Top is old news. It's over. Get rid of it.
Yeah.
Don't even use it. It's BPyTop now. Did you know this? It's the same guy. So he just redid everything to use PSUtil and Python instead of using Bash and a couple other tools. What was this? The sysstat stuff and the what was the other one? Oh, LM sensors. So he rebuilt it in Python, and it's faster, and it uses less memory. So I did a video on that too. So I've got them. They'll both be coming out back to back. Interesting.
Another that I haven't really played with that was discussed on Ubuntu podcast on the latest episode is NVTOP. So that's another one to check out too.
Ooh, I'll give it a look.
Maybe I'll drop that and check this out.
Heck yeah. Well, the reason I was doing the videos on BashTop and BPyTop is that to get the fullest features out of it, you got to compile it. And yeah, I mentioned in one of my other videos that people are allergic to the command line, and that is absolutely true. All right, well, that'll do it for our news. Let's head on down to our security update. And oh, what a security update it's going to be. The NSA, dun dun dun, reveals something about Russian hacks. So this was an interesting read. So we know that the NSA and the CIA have released a report that basically calls out this malware called DrovoRub that will allow installation of malicious kernel modules onto your system. So there was a whole lot of hubbub about, well, the CIA and the NSA don't explain how people are getting onto your computer in the first place. Yeah, that's not what this is about. This is about if someone has access to your machine, they can do this kind of thing using DrovoRub, using that particular set of that malware. So I don't know what that was about. I don't know why you have to have full, like, that you don't have to go all the way back to reconnaissance to be able to talk about an exploit that you need to have, I don't know, even root access on a box to have, because we have plenty of ways to get onto a Linux machine, and then you can use DrovoRub. So anyway, that came out a lot. It was 45 pages long, and I see a couple of comments that, you know, Page does not have a single paragraph detailing or even speculating on how the malware goes about getting the initial root access required to load a malicious kernel module. Yeah, I know, right. So anyway, the whole idea with that is that you're going to use something like, what did we talk about last time? Or was it last time? The boot hole? Maybe it was last
time. Yep, that was last episode.
Yeah, so you can use boot hole to run malicious scripts on boot to allow you to get root access onto the box, and then you can use DrovoRub. So you can use more than one exploit at a time. So yeah, I don't know what that was about. But anyway, so DrovoRub, you're probably not getting it because it needs a whole heck of a lot of work to get into your machine to get root access to be able to load one of these malicious kernel modules in the first place. But the other thing that came out alongside this is Chris Titus Tech did a video called Linux Malware and Securing Your System. And I wanted to go into that video thinking, man, this is going to be great. I'm going to be able to share this around, and I can't do it. There's a link in the show notes of this particular video, and he goes through a couple of different things. He talks about what DrovoRub is, which is fantastic. He talks about the FBI and NSA document about DrovoRub, and he also makes that comment about it doesn't explain to you how to get root access on a machine, which that's not what DrovoRub's about. Anyway, so, and then he starts going into the preventative measures that the document talks about, and then he shows you how to check your kernel module signatures. Fantastic. All that stuff is great. Then he also shows you how to check out Secure Boot, whether or not it is on. All that information is fantastic. That is definitely worth a watch. What I started to take issue with was the script that he's talking about. So he says in GitHub, it's in his GitHub, he's got a script, and it does a few different things. You can take a look at it. Basically, what it does is it'll turn on a firewall for you. It will harden syscontrol a little bit. It will prevent IP address spoofing, and it will enable fail to ban. So one of the things that he does is in the firewall, sudo ufw limit 22/tcp. So what you're doing there is you're limiting the amount of connections that you can have in a certain amount of time to port 22, which typically is SSH. That is good, but I really feel like that's not nearly enough. You really should, when you're talking about SSH, you really should be talking about not just limiting, but talking about public and private keys and turning off password authentication. That makes it way more difficult for people to get into SSH. However, what he's got in there is pretty good. What I thought was odd, and I don't know that he actually goes into it a lot in the video, but he has the firewall open up ports 80 and 443 for you. I don't know why you would do this on a desktop or anything. I don't have a good reason for it unless you're running a website off your desktop, which is weird. But maybe he's talking about it on a server, in which case, yeah, cool. But I don't know why you would open up port 80. I mean, pretty much every browser will get mad at you for going to any non-secure website at this point anyway. And I forgot. There's actually one thing that he says earlier on in the video. He says, I don't have a quote. But he basically says that, I don't know why you would be running a kernel before or 3.7 or before, because in the document it says, make sure you're running kernel 3.7 or later. And he kind of scoffs at the idea that anybody would be running that kernel. Well, RHEL 6, which is still in active support. As a matter of fact, RHEL 5 is in active support. It's in its extended life phase right now. Military uses it. Lots of government entities use it. Lots of people that do not like to change software use RHEL 5. And RHEL 6 is on kernel 2.6. So I think more beta information on that topic would just simply be, make sure you're reading the information that companies like Red Hat are putting out so that you can see if the kernel that you're getting, 2.6. Whatever RHEL's kernel is, the newest one, covers this DrovoRub attack or DrovoRub malware. I don't know. Saying, and this is why I was thinking that the UFW stuff did not pertain to servers, because RHEL 5 and RHEL 6 are still on plenty of servers. So just odd. I don't know. So yeah, this report is not for us on the desktop, because us on the desktop, I mean, half of us are already running on 5.0 and later. The other half are running on some version of 4. So I would imagine, this is not who that's for. Anyway, he also does mention, don't install untrusted kernel modules or unsigned kernels. Yep, this is the same thing as just like running any old Windows executable that you get. Just double click on that bad boy and install it. And oh no, I have malware now. Yeah, don't do that. Don't do that. There is, and actually, case in point, there is some software out there. I think it's called OpenRGB. It will control your motherboard stuff, like all the RGB lights and everything on your motherboard. But you have to insert a kernel module. Not that I don't trust any old random guy on the internet, but I don't trust any old random guy on the internet. So when it said, modify your kernel, I'm like, nope, just nope right out of there. So that's a good example of what he's talking about with the don't just trust anybody, anything. He also mentions to use Secure Boot, which again is just, it very, very much depends on the distribution and whether or not they've gotten the blessing of Microsoft to be able to sign their kernels so that Secure Boot can actually utilize those kernels and boot from them. The downside to this, though, is, as I mentioned before, boot hole is totally a thing that is not fully fixed across our Linux ecosystem. So Secure Boot is absolutely good. I'm not knocking that at all. Secure Boot is a great solution for if you care about what is being loaded up on your machine. But it is, at least right now, not the end-all be-all, but it is a link in the chain of security. So definitely a good argument there. So the other thing was that he's denying everything else incoming on that firewall, which is great. Honestly, I think you should work from there. As far as UFW goes, that should just be the default. You open up GUFW in Linux Mint or in Ubuntu or wherever, just install GUFW, choose the private profile, and then just turn it on. That is going to prevent any connection that you do not specifically request from touching your system. It will blanket deny anything that you didn't ask for. This is the safest way to run on any network that you do not own. And there's nothing wrong with running this way on a network that you do own as well. So then you work backwards. Then you say, oh, well, I have an open SSH server running on my machine. I need to be able to connect to that. Okay. Well, now you can go in and set up a rule that says port 22 over TCP is allowed. But if you're wearing your tinfoil hat hard enough, you want to also have a allow and a deny list as far as that goes, right? So yeah, 22 TCP open, but not just for anybody, for this IP address and this IP address and this IP address and this IP address. If you're trying to take your security seriously, you need to actually put in the legwork to make it right. So just opening up 22, port 22 over TCP is probably not the best idea overall. But yeah, again, add public-private key cryptography to that so that you're not even using passwords. You're using a secure file. Well, a file that hopefully you're keeping secure. Anyway, and then a thing that I don't think he actually mentioned was using custom ports. a lot of random scripts, especially things like if you've heard of Shodan. If you've heard of Shodan, Shodan basically scans the internet all day, every day for anything that looks out of the ordinary, and then it will post it in a search engine style Google search that you can just say, hey, I want to find all open printers that I can print stuff to. And you can find one, and then you can just send straight black sheets to this printer. Yeah, don't do that. That's not nice. If you've got port 22 open, you're on Shodan. If you change that port from 22 to something else, say 2222, then I'm not saying that makes you more secure. I'm just saying that shows that that will allow you to show up less in random internet scans by places like Shodan and unscrupulous people that like to in-map the entire internet over the weekend because, I mean, it's kind of fun. It's honestly kind of fun.
Security through obscurity.
Yeah, I mean, that is what it is. So that's what I'm saying. It's not something that is going to save your bacon, but it is, again, one link in the chain of security. You should be doing all of these things, right? Having a good firewall, doing obscure ports, setting up private key cryptography, all that kind of stuff, right? All of that stuff, keeping your kernels up to date, right? A link in the chain. But anyway, so my whole tirade on this was just to say, don't run a script that you don't understand, because this does a lot of things that I don't think people are going to actually understand. And while he does kind of explain what's going on there, there's a lot of stuff in that script that doesn't actually do anything. So there's under the hardened syscontrol.conf thing, he's got a few things in there. So sudo syscontrol kernel modules disabled one. So this actually disables all of your kernel modules that are not official. So, I mean, that will break things if you have installed kernel modules, say, from, he actually, in the video, he mentions VirtualBox. Yeah, you've got to compile. DKMS has to deal with all the kernel modules that VirtualBox brings in every single time you have a kernel update. And if you turn that on, it breaks that. So, again, if you don't understand what you're doing there, this is going to actually break things on your system. And then the next couple of things, he's got sudo syscontrol-a and sudo syscontrol-big A. Well, big A is just an alias for little a, and all that does is list modules. I don't know that why that would be in a script other than to just show you what you're doing, I guess. And then there's another command down there that is going to use names that most Ubuntu people do not have. So it's changing the configuration of IPv4, but it's referencing the network interface as ETH0. Ubuntu has stopped using ETH0 and has gone to the ENP style network naming since 1804. So if it does run, it quite likely won't have any effect. So yeah, again, just you got to be careful with stuff like this. Preventing IP spoofing, he's got this option in etsyhost.com to turn multi on. It allows multiple IP addresses to be associated with a name. I'm not quite sure how that prevents IP addressing spoofing. There is a no spoof option that you can turn on that does a little bit more close. It's a little closer to what I think he's talking about there. And then he goes down further and enables fail to ban, which is a fantastic utility. This one I wholeheartedly agree with. Definitely just install it. If you've got SSH open on the internet, you just install it. The defaults to fail to ban on SSH, it is enabled for SSH by default, if I remember correctly. And I think it limits it to 5, and then it'll ban your IP address for a couple hours. So fantastic. Fail to ban is a fantastic tool. But again, fail to ban is a very complex utility as well. So there's just no easy button for security. And I think that's really what I'm getting at on this. This is good advice. He's giving pretty good advice overall in this video. I think the issue I'm really taking with it is that there is no one size fits all. There is no script that you can download and run on your computer and then just feel confident, because quite likely it will break things. And not only that, quite likely it is just security theater. A lot of times you just feel good about it, but yet you're not really protecting yourself as well as you should be. So if you care about your security, if you care about DrovaRub, if you care about all of this stuff, then you're going to have to spend some time learning about what these things do so that you don't just run some random commands that you have no idea what effect they're having on your machine. Anyway, I'll get off my high horse now because I do some really dumb things.
Back to the low horse. Point,
yeah. Let's get on the low horse and let's be real for a minute. I just disabled all of the Meltdown Inspector mitigations on my laptop to get more horsepower out of it. So, you know, this is coming from a guy that doesn't really practice what he preaches a lot of times. So, you know, this is not me being holier than thou. This is just, maybe read over that script and understand what it does before you do it.
Yeah, we haven't even gotten into the whole balance between security and usability.
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, there is absolutely that. And so I went for usability on this one because I feel fairly confident turning off those mitigations because, at least to our knowledge, there is no single attack in the wild that utilizes either Meltdown or Spectre. It is currently only academic. So it works, but no one has been able to use it in the wild that we know of, right? But that's the whole point of 0 days, right? That we know of. Anyway, that's enough of that. Last thing we have on here is Alexa can be hacked, Instagram retains deleted data, Linux malware found by NSA, which is that Drover Rub thing, and FBI by ThreatWire. So the first two, who threw that in there?
No, I thought this was a nice summation of all the stuff that you went over with the Linux malware found by the NSA. And also, it has some other things. It's only a 10-minute long video, but it's ThreatWire, and they usually have really good data. Now, the Alexa can be hacked. That was, you had to click on a link, a malicious link, and it would end up giving all of your information to whoever sent you that link. But it has been corrected already. And then the Instagram retains deleted data. I believe that's still an issue. But I mostly put it in there because of that last section, just to give a good summation of what we've gone over here.
Yeah, if you thought Instagram actually deleted your stuff when you deleted it, well, I've got some oceanfront property in Colorado.
You kind of had a similar problem with Facebook. Because
yeah, well, Instagram is Facebook.
Yeah, because, you know, stuff gets shared, and so then it ends up going through other people's systems, and it kind of gets retained because other people have put things on there.
Exactly. So it doesn't go anywhere. You put it on the internet, it's there forever. Just always have that assumption, and you'll never be surprised. All right, well, that will do it, I think, for our security section. So our announcement is, as always, our next episode will be September 6th, 2020 at 2 p.m. Central U.S. time, 7 p.m. UTC, 8 p.m. British summertime. I do have a link, and I'm going to put it in there now, right there, timeanddate.com/worldclock/converter.html, add Dallas, Texas, and then put in your hometown, and that will convert you to our time, our show time, 2 p.m. U.S. Central Time, and that'll do it for the show. So, where can we find more of you, Joe?
I'm on a couple other podcasts. I'm on the Linux Link Tech Show, which you can find at www.tllts.org. I'm on the Linux Lugcast. We just recorded this last Friday. You can find us at www.linuxlugcast.com. You can catch me on MeWe, or you can send me an email, jb@mintcast.org.
And Bo is not here this go-around, but you can find him at undercastnetwork.com. Hey, look, I didn't say the. Nice. Moss.
Well, you can find me at itsmoss.com. Triad Bardic College, Peaceful Hippo, Distro Hopper's Digest. I'm on MeWe. My music's on Bandcamp and my own YouTube channel and Robert Warren's YouTube channel. You can email me moss@mintcast.org or distrohoppersdigest@gmail.com. And the COVID money is running out, people. I'm down to my savings, so please, I do have a sponsor if you feel so inclined.
Tony Hughes.
Yeah, you can find me at Hacker Public Radio. I'm host ID 338. I've just started that article series on Full Circle Magazine, so go check that out. Do an occasional blog, very, very occasional, at tony-hughes.blogspot.com. I'm on Twitter, TonyH1212, and you can get me at distrohoppersdigest@gmail.com and th@mintcast.org.
And Tony Watts.
You can email me at tw@mintcast.org. You can check out my solo acoustic stuff at facebook.com/TonyWattsMusic. Although, if I'm going to continue plugging that, I should probably get some new content up there. I'll work on that. Echoes of Savages, the band, at all the internet places.
And Josh isn't here this time around, but josh@mincast.org, josh@edublocks.org, and @all_about_code on Twitter. As for me, leochavez.org, probably about as sparse as Tony Hughes' blog, and @leochavez on Twitter. I'm also on linuxuserspace.show, and you can get your 5-minute news digest at Full Circle Weekly News. Moss, I'm in August now. Yay!
Woohoo!
And before we leave, we want to make sure to acknowledge some of the people who make Mintcast possible. Londoner, for his suggestion to use timeanddate.com. Josh, for all his work on the website. Bite Mark Hosting, for hosting mintcast.org and our Mumble server. Archive.org, for hosting our audio files. HPR, for our backup Mumble server. Hobstar, for the logo. And, of course, the Linux Mint development team for the fine distro we love to talk about every fortnight.
Thanks, Clem.
Thanks, Clem.
Thanks, Clem.
This has been another episode of the Mintcast podcast. The show notes for this episode are at mintcast.org. You can send us email at mintcast@mintcast.org. You can find more information about Linux Mint at www.linuxmint.com. You can follow both Mintcast and Linux Mint on Twitter, @mintcast and @linux_mint. Thanks to Mark Blasco at podcastthemes.com for our theme music, and thanks for listening to this episode of the Mint.
Yeah, Joseph Husak said, I thought you said it was going to be a short show. Little does he know. Exactly, yeah.